If you had lots of questions to ask God, and after a long silence he talked back, but did not answer your questions, would you, like Job, be satisfied? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author. We continue our series on the book of Job. My conversation partners are again Dave Thomas, Dean of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Jen Ogden, Associate Pastor of the Walla Walla University of Church. And I want to touch the soul of your Christian experience with that question. You had lots of questions, and God didn't answer them, but talked back to you. And maybe we need to start with that. Have you ever heard God talking back to you?
My thoughts are running along the line of your original question, Alden. After a long silence, he talked back, but did not answer your questions. I think that's the experience of all humans. Mm-hmm. Maybe not as dramatically as Job, but how many of us have questions to which we have not found answers or been given answers, and yet we persist?
Mm-hmm. And what are the factors in everyday religious experience that enable us to live with unanswerable questions? That's really what I would like to get at.
Yeah. A.W. Tozer says, to have found God and to still pursue him is the soul's paradox of love. And I think, as Paul indicates, you know, that when our roots have grown down into Christ and into his love, then we are able to grow. And I think that some of that being unanswered question is this idea of growing down into the depth, and we don't always get the answers, but we're still pursuing the answers. And I don't think that that always leads to this deep satisfaction, but I don't know that we per se get a satisfied Job so much as an answered Job. He gets a response, which repeatedly he asks for throughout this book, right? We've heard it all quarter long. He's asking, and he gets a response. But I don't know that it's every question being answered.
I don't think any of his questions are answered.
See, if to me, Alden, I think is that we get a sense that settles deep in our souls, if you want to put it that way, that there is something inherently broken in our lives that we cannot fix, and out beyond us, there is the hope of a solution that is, and that hope is linked to God. And so, because of that deep-seated hope, we hold on to belief in God and continue to try to follow him in spite of the fact we can't see everything, you know. I find the metaphor of cooking a 5-course meal, which I don't know how to do, but I find it very useful. You know, when you see a good cook at work, some things are on high heat and they are being cooked as quickly as possible. Other things are in the refrigerator for a night or a day. Other things are simmering on the back of the stove. And I think that our understanding of God is like that. There are some things that are right now hot and available. Other things are in the refrigerator, because I don't have an answer to that, and there's no sense bringing it out until its time has come. Mm-hmm. I think the same is true of human relationships. You know, we have friends who with whom friendships persist, even though we don't know all there is about them, and sometimes they offend us. I don't want to say God offends us. We are offended sometimes by our perceived actions of God, but people are somewhat enigmatic as well. We don't understand them, and yet we persist in our friendships, and we find a way to get beyond the bumps that we have. For me, it's very, very helpful. One of the things that sustains my faith is this deep-seated sense that God is out there and is presiding over the comings and goings of Earth and the universe, and that if I'm convinced of one thing, it is that when I get to be where God is, I will be able to see to my complete satisfaction that he has acted righteously. Mm-hmm. If I didn't have that deep-seated sense, I think I would be a very unhappy Christian or believer.
But my guess is, Dave, that you'd have a hard time giving me a list of how you arrived at that.
Yes, that's very true. It's almost a sense it's a deep-seated sense, but I cannot point you to specific things that have produced it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of it, and I don't know that I can say this from a memory, but C.S. Lewis, in his book Surprised by Joy, which is his spiritual autobiography, he talks about his incredible search. And he says, you must picture me alone in that room at Magdalen, night after night, sensing that whenever my mind lifted, even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Finally, Trinity Term, Oxford, 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God, and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England.
Okay, but notice now that once he did that, how many of the pieces came together?
They were together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, I mean, yeah. All the big issues of life become connected and sensible if you allow for the existence and presence of God in your life. Then all your questions don't get answered, but the cohesiveness of life is amazing.
There's little that seems to make sense in life, but a lot more makes sense with God in it.
Yeah. Well, there's a fascinating passage. We've been so keen looking for proof, and that's not where Scripture says. In Romans 8, now, for in hope we were saved. Now, hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of our older colleagues, Fritz Guy, says, hope is what you do when you don't have enough evidence to be optimistic. So you live in hope, the Lord somehow puts pieces together, mm-hmm. and you keep on keeping on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important.
Tertullian, I believe he said, hope is faith with the lamp lit. You know, and I think there's just this idea of faith burning in the darkness that something is going to come of it.
Yeah. Good.
It's brilliant.
Now, there's another aspect about this. One of the intriguing things, if you look at the list of questions which God asked of Job and which Job couldn't answer, it's very intriguing because some of those same kinds of questions Job comes up with in his chapter on wisdom in chapter 28. Furthermore, some of the questions which Elihu mentions in chapter 37 are very similar. Do you know how God controls the clouds and makes the lightning flash? Can you join him in spreading out the skies, hard as a mirror of cast bronze? But something very interesting. When Elihu tells Job that, doesn't ring the right bells. See? And so the person who tells us makes a lot of difference. Yeah. If it's someone we know and trust, and somehow Job was convinced that this was the real thing, this was God speaking out of the whirlwind, and woo, he was deeply impressed. Now, another question I want to ask. Where else in Scripture does God remind us that humans cannot really understand the things of God? Can you think of any good passages in Scripture where he says you can't really understand the things of God? Not saying that we shouldn't explore, but where he simply says there are things which are beyond your ability.
Well, there's Deuteronomy 29:29 about the secret things belonging to God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and our children.
Okay, that's so, good one.
I mean, that denotes a whole category of things that are not known to us.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And Isaiah echoes that same sentiment in Isaiah 55.
Mm-hmm.
My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor my ways your ways. Just the idea that God is so much higher and broader and deeper.
I find that a very liberating passage. You know, God is always above and beyond anything that I can explore. And that gives me the freedom to root around in Scripture. Read around in the world, but my ways are not your ways, or my thoughts your thoughts. I think that's really terribly important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other question that we need to ask here is, does the fact that God asked Job so many unanswerable questions mean that we should not ask our questions? Now, think carefully before you answer that. Because there are people who say, we don't need to ask the questions. Look, God didn't answer Job's questions, so.
I'm afraid I don't see the justification for that, Olin.
Well, I don't either, but I thought we'd toss it. Because there are people who argue that way.
Yeah. I did.
But I think that it's an argument from an ununderstanding place, from lacking in knowledge. And I just think that, I mean, God doesn't condemn Job for having asked. He never once says, that was silly of you. Why did you even bother? You should have saved your breath.
I think that's an essential part of when God says, you have not spoken the truth about me as Job has done.
As Job, yeah.
I think that what he's done, he has not given up. He has asked questions. So the problem is, you see, if you only have God's answers or non-answers, and you don't have the narrative leading up to that, you have no way of processing it. And there are some people, many people, have to go through the pilgrimage that Job went through in order to find peace in the end. So question it and root around as whatever you need to do. I think that's a really important one. So that's part of it. God published Job's questions for us all to read. They're there in the Bible. That would be some justification. And then Scripture forcefully admonishes us to search for wisdom. Book of Proverbs offers some of the clearest arguments for seeking wisdom. Chapter 2, "My child, if you accept my words and treasure up my commandments within you, making your ear attentive to wisdom, inclining your heart to understanding, if you indeed cry out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom, and from his mouth come knowledge and understanding." So I think we've got a lot of biblical mandate for doing that. Now, one of the difficulties that we face in our world, however, is when wisdom seems to destroy the ability to worship God.
Mm. Mm.
And I think we need to be aware of that. I've been struck in recent days by a couple of quotations that I've had around for a while. One is the impact of science on the people who came from the East, the devout people who find God worship easy. This is what he said. "These people came to Europe as pious youths, wedded to Krishna, Shiva, Vishnu, Hali, Rama. They touched science, and their ancient faiths were shattered as by some sudden catalytic shock. Shorn of religious belief, which is the very spirit of India, the westernized Hindus returned to their country disillusioned and sad. 1,000 gods had dropped dead from the skies." And then there's an Iranian. This one is an amazing one. Syed Hassan Nasser, a well-known Iranian professor, he said, "Ever since children began to learn Lavoisier's law that water is composed of oxygen and hydrogen, in many Islamic countries, they came home that evening and stopped saying their prayers." Now, for that very reason, this very man urged that the Saudi government not build a proposed science museum because they could see it as a time bomb that would destroy Islam.
Hmm.
Hmm.
So we have to be aware that the modern search for knowledge is not always compatible with the experience of God. One last aspect here, and we have just a few moments left. Isaiah experienced God's glory. Peter, the great catch of fish, said, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man." No questions answered, but a remarkable experience with God. So that's our time. Thank you very much. Thank you for planning to help us out again next week. And my thanks to Jared Miller, our program engineer, to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.